Black Flags, The Rise of ISIS. Author, Joby Warwick. A Troubled Childhood. Ahmed Fadil Al-Khalayri has been troubled since childhood, taking the hard path from vandalism to drugs and alcohol to more serious crimes. The Khalayris came from a large and respectable East Bank tribe, the Bani Hassans, a biographical fact that normally carried certain advantages for a young man looking to find work in a patriarchal society like Jordan. But Ahmed Al-Khalayri, later known as Abu Mus'ab Al-Zarqawi, the one from Zarqa, had blown one opportunity after the other. His criminal career began at the age of 12, gradually acquiring a reputation as a heavy drinker and street tough who took pleasure in brutalizing his victims and opponents with fist or blade. The Rise of Zarqawi. It was his mother who nudged Zarqawi into joining the Islamists and signed him up for religion classes. To everyone's surprise, Zarqawi plunged into Islam with all the passions he had once reserved for his criminal pursuits. He devoured propaganda videos and audio cassettes on the sectarian wars being fought in Afghanistan, Bosnia, and Chechnya. And when the prayer leader at the local mosque asked for volunteers to fight against the communist suppressors of Afghanistan's Muslims, Zarqawi's hands shot up. Zarqawi fought with enthusiasm and quickly gained a reputation for bravery bordering on foolhardiness. By the time he left Afghanistan, he was a combat veteran with years of battlefield experience. He had been steeped in the doctrine of militant Islam, learning at the feet of radical Afghan and Arab clerics who would later ally themselves with the Taliban or with Osama bin Laden. A problem like that always comes back. In 1993, Abu Mus'ab al-Zarqawi returned home to a country he barely recognized. He started to track down an old acquaintance from Afghanistan, the preacher and scholar named Abu Muhammad al-Maqdisi. The two started a partnership that began with Quranic study groups for other Afghan veterans and progressed to the organizing of small cells for more ambitious endeavors. They had a small stock of weapons, hidden in Maqdisi's household furniture. The spark that propelled the group into action came on February 25, 1994, when a Jewish extremist opened fire on prayer Muslims. The spark that propelled the group into action came on February 25, 1994, when a Jewish extremist opened fire on praying Muslims in a religious shrine in the West Bank town of Hebron, killing 29 men and boys and wounding scores of others. Incensed by the murders, the group decided to use their weapons in coordinating attack on Israel outpost along the border. The plan called for striking the guard station with back-to-back suicide bombs, followed by small arms fire. But the Mukhabarat, the Jordanian intelligence agency, inevitably learned of the plan and moved quickly to squash it. This ended with the arrest of Zarqawi on March 29. On February 7, 1999, the death of King Hussein bin Talal was announced. A few weeks later, his son became King Abdullah II. In a tradition dating back to Jordan's founding, new kings are expected to declare a general amnesty in the country's prisons, granting royal pardons to inmates convicted of nonviolent offenses or political crimes. A list prepared by the parliament was sent to the palace for the final approval. The king, just 6 weeks into his new job, faced a choice of either adopting the list or sending it back for weeks of additional debate. He signed it. Many months would pass before he learned that the list had included certain Arab Afghans who should have been disqualified. But by that time, there was nothing the King of Jordan could do. The road to Afghanistan. Zarqawi headed to Pakistan, but he struggled to maintain connections and travel documents. 6 months later, Pakistani officials notified him that his visa had expired and he would have to leave the country. Zarqawi chose to move to Afghanistan. He made his way to Kandahar, eventually arriving at the headquarters of one of the former Afghan Arabs who might have been expected to welcome him, Osama bin Laden. But instead of getting a warm greeting from his old Mujahideen comrade, Zarqawi was rudely snubbed. The Qaeda founder sent one of his aides to check out the Jordanian. After exchanging traditional greetings, Zarqawi presented his one big idea, the re-establishment of Islam in society. And he had rigid views on what such society should look like. Zarqawi was given money to start his own training camp, especially catering to Islamist volunteers from Jordan and other countries of the Levant, as well as Iraq and Turkey. After the events of 9/11, Zarqawi's Herat base, along with bin Laden's, were targeted by the Americans. Zarqawi collected his followers and fled to Iraq's northeastern mountains, where he set about recreating the training camp he has established in Afghanistan. Three attacks. Whether deliberately or by coincidence, Zarqawi picked targets that would confound US ambitions for Iraq and ensure that the occupation of the country would be long and painful. An opening salvo against his country's embassy effectively discouraged other Muslim nations from participating in Iraq's rebuilding in a way that might have given the Americans legitimacy. This blow was followed by another two that in sequence showed brilliant strategy. By attacking the UN, he drove out all the non-governmental organizations and discouraged anyone from opening an embassy. Then he went after Shia-Sunni fault line with attacks on Shiite mosques. First, he isolated Americans and then he put them in the midst of civil war. The end of Abu Mus'ab al-Zarqawi. In May 2006, at the Balad Air Base in Iraq, the interrogation of an Iraqi detainee called Mubasir had stalled completely. Then from the Mukhabarat came records of one man's past travels to Jordan, including several suspicious trips right around the time of Amman hotel bombings the previous November. Faced with new evidence, the man broke down. His confessions took up 8 pages of typed notes. The highlight was a remarkable revelation about Sarqawi. The Jordanian had a spiritual advisor, a Iraqi imam called Sheikh Abdurrahman, and the two men met regularly, about once every week to 10 days. For 2 weeks, airborne cameras watched the house of the imam in Baghdad and followed his silver sedan on its mundane trips to markets, schools, and social outings. Then, around noon on a stifling hot Wednesday, June 7, 2006, the Americans watched the sedan broke from its usual orbit outside a tiny village called Hibhib. The car turned onto a small dirt road linked with thick groves of palm trees, and then proceeded down a driveway leading to a beige two-story house with a carport. A solidly built figure emerged from the building. A man dressed in all black, who turned out to be Zarqawi, came out and met Rahman and took him into the house. It was nearly 6 p.m. when the command came over to the American F-16 fighter jet to drop the bomb. When the smoke cleared out, the two-story house was gone. Gravely wounded, but alive, Zarqawi opened his eyes to see a ring of American faces looking down at him. He died an hour later. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. Ibrahim Awad al-Badri is the son of conservative Muslim preacher from the Iraqi city of Samarra. His self-chosen jihadist name was Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. He was in his late teens when the Iran-Iraqi war ended in a bitter stalemate, and was nearly 20 when the Iraqi army suffered its defeat in the first Gulf War. In 1999, he earned a bachelor's degree in Islamic law and theology in Baghdad. When the US invasion of Iraq began on March 20, 2003, Baghdadi signed up with one of the many small resistance movements that engaged in hit-and-run attacks against US troops. A few months later, he was caught. His scholarly qualities not only helped him gain respect among fellow detainees, but also allowed him to gain an early release. In late 2004, prison panel reviewed his record and decided that he posed little threat. Baghdadi returned to school to earn his doctorate degree in Islamic law. In 2006, his old organization had emerged with several others in advisory council, created by Zarqawi, and Baghdadi was asked to be one of the council's advisors on matters concerning Sharia law, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, ISIS. Zarqawi's death changed everything. The heirs to the Jordanians' Al-Qaeda in Iraq movement had different ideas about how to run an insurgency, and they quickly reorganized themselves under a new name, the Islamic State of Iraq. And in early 2010, Baghdadi was appointed as the top Sharia official for the entire organization, which made him the third-ranking officer. In April 18, 2010, U.S. missiles and Iraqi rockets flattened a safe house outside the city of Tikrit, eliminating the group's number one and two leaders in a single blow, and Baghdadi stood alone at the head of the Islamic State of Iraq. In 6 months of Syria's 2011 uprising, Baghdadi was ready to make a move. He tapped one of his most trusted deputies, a native Syrian and a veteran from the Zarqawi days, to lead an expedition into the Syrian heartland. Outside the capital, the institutions that maintained security within Syria were failing, one by one, and this was Baghdadi's chance. The plan to establish a Syrian-run Islamist militia to join the rebels already battling Bashar al-Assad's government. This militia was called Jabhat al-Nusra, the support front for the peoples of Greater Syria. On April 9, 2013, Baghdadi announced a major organizational restructuring. He said that the group known as al-Nusra Front was officially banished, and its place was a heavily merged organization that Baghdadi called the Islamic State of Iraq and al-Sham. The later word, roughly synonymous with the English term Levant, referred to the lands of Eastern Mediterranean, from southern Turkey through present-day Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, and Palestine. English speakers would know the organization as ISIL, or ISIS.